This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. A bit later in the show, we'll hear from Bill Hader. He's nominated for an Emmy for his work on Saturday Night Live, where he's been a cast member for 7 seasons. But first, Ira Glass, the creator and host of This American Life, and Mike Birbiglia, a regular contributor to the show. They've collaborated on a new film comedy called Sleepwalk With Me. They co-wrote the film. Ira's one of the film's producers, and Mike directed and stars in it. Sleepwalk With Me is a fictionalized version of an autobiographical story that Mike's told on This American Life, as well as in an off-Broadway one-man show and a memoir. It's about finding his voice as a comic, relationship problems, and his really dangerous sleepwalking disorder. Birbiglia was diagnosed with REM behavior disorder, in which you act out the behavior you're dreaming, and you often dream that you're being chased. Before we get to Terry's interview with Ira Glass and Mike Birbiglia, let's listen to a clip from Birbiglia's one-man show. It was recorded at The Moth in Brooklyn and was broadcast on This American Life in 2008. Here, Birbiglia is describing a sleepwalking incident that nearly killed him while he was staying at a La Quinta Inn in Walla Walla, Washington, where he had a comedy gig.
I fell asleep, and I had a dream that there was a guided missile headed towards my room. And there's all these military personnel in the room with me, and I jump out of bed, and I'm like, what's the plan? And they say, it's come to our attention, the missile coordinates are set specifically on you. And I thought, that's very bad. Because, I don't have a plan for that one. So I decided to jump out the window in my dream. And as it turns out, in my life. And there are two important details. One, I was on the second floor of La Quinta Inn, and two, the window was closed. So I jumped through a window like the Hulk. And I say that because that's how I described it at the emergency room in Walla Walla, Washington. I was like, you know the Hulk, you know, he just kind of jumps through stuff. So I jump through the window and I scream, ah! And what was remarkable is that people with this disorder are capable of doing things they couldn't do in their everyday life. It's like blacking out drinking, where you don't feel any pain or inhibition. I jumped through a second-story window, and I landed on the front lawn of the hotel. I took a spill. I got back up, and I kept running.
In the fictionalized movie version of Sleepwalk With Me, Mike Birbiglia plays Matt Pandemiglio, a comic living in a small New York City apartment with his girlfriend Abby, played by Lauren Ambrose. While Abby's pressuring Matt to get married, he's trying to launch his comedy career. Matt finally gets some dates at small venues, but audiences haven't been laughing. In this scene, he's just had a terrible set, opening for comic Mark Maron. After the show, Maron, who plays himself, has this talk with Birbiglia's character, Matt.
Hey, you did okay, man.
Yeah?
Well, okay is kind of a strong word, but you tanked. I thought it was funny, but I'm a comic. I'm sick, so...
Yeah.
All right. You just got to keep telling yourself you're killing, and it'll all fall into place. You'll figure it out.
Thanks.
You married, or?
No. Well, kind of. I don't know. I have a girlfriend, and serious, you know. It's just, we've been together for a long time.
You all right, man?
Yeah. It's just, I've decided that I'm not going to get married until I'm sure that nothing else good can happen in my life.
You should say that on stage.
Yeah, that wouldn't go over so well at home.
We're not at home.
Are you married?
Kinda.
That's my guest, Mike Birbiglia, with Marc Maron from Mike's new film, Sleepwalk With Me, which he co-wrote and directed. And also with us is Ira Glass, who co-wrote and produced the film. Welcome to both of you, and congratulations on the movie. So,
thanks.
Thank you.
Mike, this has been a comedy monologue, a popular This American Life piece, a one-man show, a book. So was there a little part of you that was saying, I'm tired of this story, I want to move on to a different story?
Well, we're working on the video game, and it's really yeah. shed a lot of light on what really happened. Now, absolutely. because it's so personal, and it's something I live with every day, and that my wife, Jenny, lives with every day. And so in some ways, I did want to get away from it. But, you know, Ira was making this point to me early on, which is like, the film audience is just size-wise so much larger and wider than the niche audience that you're playing to, that it's actually telling it to an entirely different group of people. And so I felt like that was a good reason.
I was surprised when we got to shooting how flashbacky it was for you. Like, it hadn't occurred to me until we filmed, right, we're putting you back into a hotel room where you're going to have to reenact jumping through the window. And it hadn't occurred to me that it would be emotional for you to do that. And I remember it wasn't until we started shooting those scenes that it was like, oh, right, this is utterly real.
Was it emotional for you to go back and reenact those things?
It was, yeah. It was, and we shot at La Quinta Inn, at an actual La Quinta Inn, and I had jumped out a window at a La Quinta Inn. And while we were shooting there, for the convenience of the production, I stayed in a room at La Quinta Inn. And so it was like, I mean, and so I was acting out a scene from my life, and meanwhile living in the situation where, you know, I was very sleep deprived and I was very anxious, which are two of the things that aggravate sleep issues. And so it was not ideal, I have to say.
It's funny because I, at some point during the shooting, you told me that you were doing a lot of sleepwalking as we were shooting. Like, when you would go home at night, we would have these, you know, 16-hour, 17-hour days to shoot, and which is really bad for somebody with your disorder. And you would be sleepwalking, and the sleepwalks would be about making the movie.
Yeah, my brain would not shut off when I would go to sleep. And so I would have dreams that I was directing myself in a scene in my bedroom, and that the cameras were rolling, and I would actually be, my wife wouldn't be asleep yet. She goes to bed later than me, and she would walk into the bedroom, and I would be adjusting lights. And my wife would be like, what are you doing? And I'd say, we're shooting. And she'd say, Mike, we're not shooting. And I'd say, I'm sorry, but we are. The way I would say it was actually sort of patronizing. Like, she didn't get it.
So, but I thought that nowadays you're sleeping in a sleeping bag with mittens on so that you can't get up and walk while you're asleep.
I don't use the mittens as much anymore just because they're so restrictive, but I do sleep in the sleeping bag. But, you know, you can get out of the sleeping bag. It just takes a little more. It takes a little more maneuvering, and so I could have. I'll sometimes have incidents, but they're nothing like. And also, I take a medication that was based on my diagnosis, which is called REM behavior disorder, and so. Even the sleepwalking incidents I have are much calmer than the ones that I used to have. The RBD incidents are commonly like sprinting away from, you know, military folk or animals or wild animals, or, geez, you know, they're terrifying. Like, I need to get away from here or I will be killed, kind of urgency. And the medication I have does not allow for me to feel that way.
My guests are Ira Glass, the creator and host of This American Life, and comic and actor Mike Birbiglia. They co-wrote the movie Sleepwalk with Me. Ira produced it, Mike directed and stars in it. It's based on Mike's experiences with a sleepwalking disorder. His monologue about it was broadcast on This American Life in 2008. So, Ira, here's a question for you. When you first heard Mike's monologue, Sleepwalk with Me, and you wanted to put it on your show, and this was years before you collaborated on the movie Sleepwalk, did you feel like you needed to fact check, does he really sleepwalk like that? And, like, jump out of a window in a motel? It just sounds so extreme. Did you ask to, like, see his scars or, like, you know, call a psychiatrist and ask about it?
I mean, truthfully, if we put the story on our show today, we would do that. But that was years ago, and we weren't doing that with these personal monologues. On This American Life, we had this incident with Mike Daisy, where Mike Daisy came onto our show and told a bunch of things, and we fact-checked. And as I've said on the air, like, we didn't do it properly. And since then, because we learned later that he had misrepresented himself in a number of ways in a monologue about Apple computers. Since then, we've been much more aggressive about fact-checking everything, and people who come on doing personal monologues have the unfortunate experience of us calling and fact-checking everything. So if we would have run the piece today, we actually would have fact-checked the entire thing.
How would you have done that?
Well, in this case, I mean, I feel like we would ask to see, I mean, any photographs or medical records. I mean, we would ask to talk to somebody who knew Mike at the time. We would just ask for any kind of proof that he could give us that the thing had actually happened. But at the time, because it was he recorded it as part of the Moth storytelling series, which purports to be true, we really didn't think about it. I mean, at the time, our feeling was, well, even if this isn't completely true, it kind of doesn't matter. He's just a funny guy telling a story. And we just didn't think about it the same way that we thought about the journalism on the show,
mm-hmm.
Where everything is, you know, at a much higher standard.
Well, but now you're convinced it's true.
I am convinced it's true. I've seen photographs, and I am 100% convinced it's true, yes.
Okay.
Ira called me after the Mike Daisy incident occurred, and he goes, Mike, you better jump through that window.
That's really funny. So let's talk a little bit about the process of transforming this monologue into a movie. The first thing we see in the film, and this is a very important decision in terms of how you decided to make the film, the first thing we see is you, Mike, in the car, talking to us, the viewer, in an acknowledgement that you're making a movie and that we're watching the movie. And so the first thing you tell us is to turn off the cell phone.
Yeah.
Okay, so why did you decide to start that way? You know, as a monologue to the viewer, acknowledging that you're in a movie on screen, that we are watching it, and that you don't want us to interrupt your movie with our cell phone.
There's a funny sequence of events that led to those monologues being in the car. The way it was written in the script was that the monologues in the film are embedded in the scenes, akin to like Matthew Broderick movie Ferris Bueller, where you'll be in the middle of eating lunch with someone and then you'll look over at the camera and say, here's how this lunch is going, that kind of thing. And we shot it that way. And then what we found was that when we got into the edit, that somehow that was just too campy. It wasn't fitting with the tone of the film, which was kind of like an autobiographical, realistic tone. And then the other thing that was happening is that the laughs weren't that good. In the movie, like, we did test screenings with all these This American Life Facebook fans. Ira would literally post two or three times a week.
Yeah, two or three times a week all fall. These were the most low-rent test screenings where we would basically go onto the This American Life Facebook group and we would say, like, we're going to do a screening of a thing. We can't tell you what it is, but just show up. It's free. And then 70 or 80 people would show up.
People would have no idea what they were coming to see because we couldn't say what it was. We didn't want distributors coming and seeing early cuts of it, that kind of thing. So it was very below the radar. And And so what we found was that we showed the movie and no one was laughing at the parts that we thought were really funny. And so me and Ira and Seth Barish, my co-director, and Jeff Richman, who is our brilliant editor, had this kind of banging our heads against the wall. And finally we said, you know what? I think the reason it's not getting laughs is that it's too sad that what we're watching is the disintegration of a serious romantic relationship and this guy's deteriorating health, and it's just not funny. It's too sad. And so what we decided, and it was funny because it was just at first it was me and Jeff Richman in the edit suite just taking out a digital camera, and he would shoot me monologuing to camera as though it were in the past, as though it, instead of in the present.
And so the monologue's in the present, but the action's in the past.
Yeah, and precisely. And so I was going, you know, so what happened was blank, as opposed to here's what's happening now. Mm-hmm. And we dropped those in to the movie in the test screenings, and all of a sudden, things that got no laughs, all of a sudden we're getting big laughs. We were like, oh, we're really on to something, so let's place this somewhere. And I had always had this idea. It was actually my brother Joe and I had conceived of this idea like a couple years ago, but had never done it, which was, what if all the monologues of the film are based inside a car? And it's just very casual. I'm driving a car and I'm talking to the audience member and guiding them through the story.
So Ira, you arranged these test screenings through the This American Life Facebook page. You know, so many filmmakers really hate test screenings and focus groups because the outcome of those is often, okay, so we're going to take the tragic ending of your film and turn it into a happy ending because the audience had a better response. And it's usually out of the director's hands, and like some, like there's like a studio or a producer or somebody who's saying, this is the change you have to make because it's more popular. So you were doing these, yourself, so there weren't people above you who were going to tell you what you needed to do. But did you have any doubts about the focus group process? Like, you don't do focus groups for This American Life. Like, you have confidence that you know what works, and you do it.
That's true, but in the course of making any story, especially a big complicated story, the process of the radio show is that we go through it again and again and again. We re-edit and re-edit and re-edit. And on each new edit, draft of the story, we bring in somebody who has never heard it, mm-hmm. To get the reaction of somebody who's never heard it. So in a way, pulling in a test audience for these redrafts that we were doing on the film felt exactly like that. It's like we could give it to fresh eyes and see where it would work. And really, when you're doing a comedy, it's so important to find out where the laughs are and if things are getting laughs, and you can adjust the jokes to make the laughs work better.
Did you give them, like, questionnaires or just, like, listen where the laughs were? Did you do a Q&A afterwards? What was your way of getting as much information as you could?
At the end of each one, I would go up in front of the group and ask a bunch of questions on things we were wondering about. You know, you can edit so quickly now. We had a rough cut, 4 or 5 days later that we could start to show to people and start to change. And at the beginning, and really for the first, like, month and a half of that process, the big problem in the film is that people didn't buy the relationship between Mike and his girlfriend, which is the central relationship in the film. And people just didn't see why they were together, and they just didn't buy them. And we tried many, many things to fix it. And so one of the things I would go up and ask the audience is, like, do you like him? Do you like her? Do you believe them as a couple? What do you think of them as a couple? And in the early screenings, like, Mike, I hope this isn't an exaggeration, like, people, like, not only did their relationship, like, it made people mad. Like, it made people mad at them and mad at us. Like people who were close to us would think, like, what is wrong with you? Have you never been in a relationship? Like, do you not understand what it's like to be in love? We would get comments like that. Like, people got very mean about it, and we just went in and adjusted a number of things. Most dramatically, like, somebody told us about this movie trick that I had never heard of, and that is completely
different.
I told you about it. Yeah.
There's a whole book about it called Save the Cat. Which is essentially, if you have a character that's unrelatable in a script, have them do something nice early in the film, a la saving a cat. And from that point on, that people will like the character. And I kind of, truth be told, I kind of hate the book because I think it's so simple, and I think it's used kind of for evil in certain ways by studios. They'll be like, we need him to save the cat more. And then it's like a whole movie about saving a cat. But I feel like it actually was an applicable lesson to our film.
So what's your cat moment? Yeah.
We put in a scene, it's like 40 seconds long, and it's like the third scene of the film. And basically Mike just picks up the girlfriend from work. Nothing happens. Like, if you notice, nothing happens. He brings her some water and some nuts. They have like a little chat about where they're going. You don't need the scene to make the story work, because you could just skip it and it works. All that happens is that you see that they get along. That's literally the only message of the scene. And once we put it in, it was like a miracle cure. And I have to say, like I've been making stories on the radio my entire adult life. Like, and I feel like I knew every trick to make a story work on the radio. You move this thing to here, and you raise the stakes this way, and you raise a question this way. That was like something I had no idea. I had no idea this was a move.
So, Ira, you're a producer of the movie Sleepwalk With Me. What does that mean? What was your job?
Oh, my God. It means nothing good. It means nothing good. I honestly, like, I don't understand why people produce movies. Like you're not doing any of the central creative work. Like, you're not the screenwriter, really. I mean, I ended up getting involved heavily in the screenwriting with this, just because Mike and I are so close. But like, you're not the screenwriter. You don't get the pleasure of writing. You don't get the pleasure, really, of editing. You don't get the pleasure of directing. You don't get the pleasure of performing. You know, like, you don't get to do any of the fun things. What you do
so
is...
So you do make a cameo as the photographer in the wedding scene.
I do make a cameo, yes. But you know, you don't get to do any of the things that are super fun about making work. And instead, you're responsible for the entire thing. You're frightened for months that it's not going to work. You're constantly corralling people, and then you are the annoying person looking over people's shoulders saying, like, well, what if we held this shot for like 8 more frames? You know, like all you're doing is looking over people's shoulders, kind of backseat driving every part of the process, which is not pleasant. And it's just like, honestly, it's just a terrible job.
I just want to say for the record that Ira's quote-unquote backseat driving feels a lot like front seat driving.
Noted. But that's more like being a radio producer. When you're a radio producer, you're the one in charge in a weirdly different way. You know, like when I'm producing somebody's story for the radio show, like I'm thinking through all the plot points with them and directing them in the studio myself, and you know what I mean, like doing the editing myself on the computer. And so it's just a different, it's a very different thing that some people, I'm sure, are cut out for.
Mike, one of the things that you say in the movie as a comic is that you have to be delusional to be a comic. And you say, if it weren't for denial, I wouldn't be a comedian. You have to be able to walk on stage and bomb and walk off and think, that went great. And so, I mean, even in comedy, from the way you describe it, I'm sure this is true, you have to have confidence in what you're doing, even if it's not fully worked out yet. Otherwise, you couldn't possibly perform.
That's absolutely true. And I think it was also true of making the film. Like, you know, making your first film is a really, it's a very bold and audacious are the positive words that you would associate with it. The negative words might be delusional or insane. You really have to sort of walk. It's like you're walking on the bus for the field trip in seventh grade, and you say to all your fellow students, like, so everybody, guess what? I'm gonna drive the bus. And then people are like, but you don't know how to drive the bus. And you're like, I know, but I've been watching the bus driver, and I feel like I have the hang of it. I've been watching other bus rides. I know which ones I like. I know which ones I don't like. I feel like I've developed an aesthetic of bus driving. And man, does it not work with some people. Like some people, and I would say on this film, a majority of the people who made the film, and it was a wildly collaborative effort. And in this case, like, they got enough people got on the bus.
So I have one more question. Ira, this one's for you. I remember you back when your press photo, your publicity shot was you with a piece of paper covering your face because you wanted to be you wanted to be a radio person and not a visual presence. And we all,
yes.
Most of us on radio really cherish the invisibility of it because
yes.
you're just a voice. You don't have to think about what you're wearing or your hair or your body. People aren't going to judge you on how you look or whether you're attractive enough. And people can always imagine you're really, you know, fantastic looking and you don't have
or
to really
won't imagine
be
anything
in real
at all.
Life.
Or you'll just be a voice.
You could just be a voice. But now, I mean, you've got not only like the cameo and Sleepwalk, but you do these like movie theater versions of This American Life where you're on the large screen and you had your TV series and everything. So you as a presence are a very visual presence now. Which I'm sure has changed your life in some surprising ways. And if so, I'm kind of curious to hear about it. And if it's changed how you feel about your physical presence.
I mean, it hasn't changed that much. I mean, occasionally somebody will spot me on the street and say they're a fan of the radio show. But even that's pretty low key. Like, honestly, it hasn't changed very much. I mean, honestly, the reason why I gave up the idea that I would never be photographed to publicize the radio show was because after 2 years of doing it, my sisters, Karen and Randy, informed me that it was just obnoxious. Like it was funny for 2 minutes and then...
Or that
and
it
then,
became something then, of a shtick. But then you had to just be out there and then, be comfortable with yourself being out there.
Yes, but I know. But I feel like you're stuck with that if you want to publicize anything. Like as it turns out, you can't publicize a radio show in America without having yourself photographed. Like, no one will write an article about you unless they can take a picture to go along with it. And so then you're kind of stuck, and then you're being photographed, and then you have to think about what you look like. And then I just decided I wasn't going to care. I cared for a while, and then I just decided, like, I weigh more than I want to, and I don't like the way my hair looks, and I don't think about my clothes. And you know what? I'm just not – I could devote energy to caring about that, but it's just – I just don't want to. I don't want to think about it, and I don't have to, and it doesn't matter. And there came a point in doing – when we did the TV show, I consciously set out to lose weight to be on television, not because anybody asked me to, but because I knew I was going to have to look at a lot of pictures of myself. And like anybody over 40, that is not something you look forward to. And I just thought, like, I just want to make that process more – like make something I could stand. And so I've I just try not to think about it. Like that's really like, that's my incredibly sophisticated technique, is just like, I feel like it's part of running a business and I'm in public and I don't mind it and I don't cherish it either.
Appearing
visually. Yeah.
I don't know if you mind me telling this story or not, but I feel like Ira in some ways is the least phased or the least changed by his own celebrity of anyone who I've ever encountered. Like, one time we were in a Starbucks and getting coffee, and this guy just came up to Ira and was like, "Hey, you're Ira Glass." And Ira was like, "Yeah." And he just started, like, the guy just started pitching Ira a story for the radio show. He started telling this long, elaborate story. And I was like, "Oh, yeah, Ira, we got to go." You know, I was just trying to bail him out, like you would your friend at a party who was being hit on. And Ira didn't want to leave. Like, he's listening to this guy's story, and we're leaving. We walk down the street, and I go, "Ira, what are you doing? You just talk to random people, the Starbucks, about their stories?" And I was like, yeah, that's what I do. That's my whole job.
Sometimes those stories work out.
Did that ever happen that you got a story on the street that you used on your show?
Not on the street, but I have gotten stories from people walking up to me.
You have just encouraged everybody to walk
up to you.
And I know.
That's why I'm saying you don't have to use that if Ira's uncomfortable with it.
You are no
true.
Longer safe anywhere.
Terry Gross speaking with Ira Glass and Mike Birbiglia. Their new film, Sleepwalk With Me, is now playing in New York. It begins opening in other cities next week. Coming up, Saturday Night Live's Bill Hader. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Bill Hader, is nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series for his work on Saturday Night Live. He's the first male SNL cast member to be nominated in that category since Eddie Murphy back in 1983. After joining the cast in 2005, Hader became known for his characters Stefan, the New York City correspondent, and Vinny Vedecci, the Italian talk show host. He's done impressions of actors, including Clint Eastwood, Charlie Sheen, Alan Alda, Vincent Price, and Al Pacino, and political figures, including Rick Perry, James Carville, and Elliot Spitzer. He's also had supporting roles in several films, including Superbad, Adventureland, and Men in Black 3. Before we hear Terry's interview with Bill Hader, let's listen to a clip from this past season of Saturday Night Live, featuring Hader as Stefan, an awkward club kid who somehow got a job as the city correspondent on Weekend Update. He's supposed to recommend fun weekend events in New York City, but his recommendations always focus on the most bizarre underground clubs. Here's Weekend Update host Seth Meyers.
It's Christmas time in New York, which means millions of tourists will be coming to see what holiday magic the Big Apple has to offer. Here with some tips on where you and your children should go is our city correspondent, Stefan.
Hi.
Hi. Hi, Stefan. It's an exciting time, isn't it?
I know, right? So many Republican candidates. Who do you pick?
Okay, so Stefan, a lot of families are making their way to Manhattan to have some holiday fun. Are there any places you can recommend?
Yes. If you're looking to get festive with your family, I've got the perfect place for you. New York's hottest club is Hey! Built from the bucket list of a dying pervert, this Battery Park bitch parade is now managed by overweight game show host Fat Sajak. And this place has everything. Tweakers, skeevies, Spud Webb, a child, and a Russian guy who runs on the treadmill in a Cosby sweater. So come on down this weekend. The bouncer is a bulldog who looks like Wilford Brimley, and the password is
diabetes.
Bill Hader, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the Emmy nomination and on the birth of your baby daughter. Your second child.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah. So, well, quite a time for you.
Yeah.
So, we just heard one of your most popular characters on Saturday Night Live, Stefan. I'm going to ask you to describe him in your words.
Will you describe a gay nightmare was one, one way to describe Stefan. The character came from John Mulaney, who's a writer on the show, and it was two things. John got an email from a guy describing a club in New York, and it had that format of the Stefan update features. It was almost a Mad Libs version of that, which was New York's hottest club is blank. It has everything, blank, 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 you know. So he was showing me this email, and we were kind of laughing about it. And then I had this guy who worked at a coffee shop in Chelsea who I would go to every morning on my way to work, and he had that kind of hair, and that's how he talked. He was really like, oh my God, my mom is staying with me, and I live like on the lower east side. That's what he said. I live like low east side. And I would walk around the office going lower east side and like all this, and John Mulaney was the smart one and said, hey, we should write that up.
And another thing, you're always putting your hands over your mouth in that character?
Yeah. Yeah, that is part of the character, and it's become a thing where people think I'm trying not to laugh, but I understand why they would think that, because sometimes actually I'm trying not to laugh. But that is just part of the character of, yeah, he's just nervous, he's fidgety, and he's afraid he's going to say the wrong thing, I think.
Because he is.
yeah, he's always, that's what kind of is funny to me, is that he's very conscious that he's making a mistake. And so he's kind of covering up his mouth.
So I've read that John Mulaney, who writes the character with you, sometimes puts in a line in the teleprompter or cue cards or whatever it is that you use that you don't know is going to be in it, and it throws you and it makes you laugh.
Yeah.
And you're not supposed to laugh when you're in character on Saturday Night Live, but it's become such a thing for Stefan that it's like it's part of the character now.
Yeah, and now it's this weird thing. If you don't laugh, is it still a Stefan? I got through one of the dress rehearsals without laughing and felt very good about myself, and then John took upon himself to change that. He was like, don't get too excited. I mean, the other thing I should also say is that the guys miking me are laughing. The cue card guys are looking at me. They're kind of laughing. I mean, from the point when I show up that day, you know, and I walk into work on that Saturday, the cue card guys are like, hey, we just read the stuff on. Oh, boy. You know what I mean? You're dead.
Well, give us a sense of, like, if there's a line clean enough for you to say on our show, which is broadcast earlier than Saturday Night Live.
Oh, yeah.
So give us a sense of the kind of thing he writes that breaks you up.
We had a club promoter whose name was Amnesia Bernstein, which we thought was very funny. And we did it at the Dress, and it didn't really get anything. We were like, oh, that didn't work. And it was 10 minutes before we go into air, and I was in the cold open or something, and John was like, oh, we need to change that club promoter's name. And I go, I don't know. And he goes, I'll think of something. I'll think of something, because I, you know, I'm dressed up as John Boehner or something. I'm like, I got to go. And so I run away, and he put it in. And as I was walking out, he goes, oh, I changed the club promoter's name. I was like, oh, great. And went out and did it, and he changed it to Gay Liotta. And I completely lost it. And I just went, oh, what? And so what I'm seeing is the camera guys are laughing. The cue cards are shaking because the cue card guys are laughing. Beyond the cue cards, I can see some of the writers. I can see Andy Samberg, people against the wall in 8H. They're all laughing. And then that kind of started it, I think, in John's mind. He went, oh, wow, okay. Because I'm a soft touch. At the table reads, I break constantly. If something is out up there that I'm not expecting, I can't help myself. I'll start laughing. But especially as Stefan, to get myself in that character, I do kind of like work myself up a little bit, because he's so kind of nervous and jittery that I think I'm more prone to laugh. And John knows that. So it's kind of, it's now like, oh, let's go out and watch Bill eat it.
Let's hear another clip from the Emmy-nominated episode. And this is a movie trailer, and you're both the narrator for the trailer, but you're also one of the many, many, many actors in the movie, and you are Alan Alda in this trailer. So here's my guest, Bill Hader.
This Friday, from the makers of Valentine's Day and New Year's Eve, comes the story of the whole world coming together on one night to celebrate the apocalypse.
You know, I love this whole Armageddon thing, you know, brimstone and hellfire, you know. Just the other day, I strangled a guy for some flashlight batteries.
Starring literally thousands of your favorite celebrities.
As Bill Hader, as the announcer, and as Alan Alda in that trailer from Saturday Night Live. So how did you start doing Alan Alda?
That is such a good question. I think Lauren would love it if I came in and was like, I got a really good Robert Pattinson or something. You know, somebody. But instead I'm like, you know, I was watching Trouble in Paradise. I think I could get Herbert Marshall really well. And someone who's alive and working now, you know. So Alan Alda was like the closest, because I'm like, he's in Tower Heist. He's in Wanderlust. He's still working. He's Alan Alda. I mean, he's a national treasure, you know. And that came from watching Crimes and Misdemeanors with my wife. And I just started doing it, watching the movie, and because he's so funny in that movie, and I was just doing it while we were watching the movie. And again, like John Mulaney, she was like, oh, you should do that on the show. And I was like, oh, really? And so we did it in another sketch that Colin Jost wrote. It was audition tapes for Back to the Future, and it was Alan Alda auditioning for the role of Biff, the bully. And he was like, hey, why don't you make like a tree and get out of here, you know? I really love this. It's such a great, great script. And so we thought that was just really funny. And that he's very nice. And that he's such a nice, gregarious guy, and very complimentary. And then one time, John Mulaney and I tried to write a thing with Alan Alda. This was what it was called in the sketch, because there was that show out with William Shatner called the, you know, S expletive My Dad Says. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So we had my roommates a blank horse, an effing horse, and with Alan Alda, and it was him with his, you know, I got this horse for a roommate, and and it was him like trying to have a date, and he would come home and go, "Oh, well, these horses in the house," you know. It was like, and no one laughed. We did it at the Wednesday table read, and it played to silence. It was one of those things where we were doing it, and I'm doing it, and you can hear people, like, you know, folding their legs, you know, crossing their legs and, like, digging in their pockets to check their cell phone. You know, you can actually hear it. Like, it was really bad.
What did you do for your Saturday Night Live audition?
I played Vinny Videcci, the Italian talk show host, doing impressions. So I did Vinny Videcci doing Al Pacino, James Mason, Peter Falk, I can't remember.
Gregory Peck?
Gregory Peck, thank you. And you know who else? That morning they called me. My audition was at 2. My manager called me at 9 in the morning and said, they want a political impression from you and it can't be George Bush. And I just went on C-SPAN and I saw this thing, and it was like a live meeting of Parliament, and Tony Blair went up and spoke, and I listened to Tony Blair, and then I called my friend who's from the UK, and I was like, "Who's this?" And I did it, and he was like, "Is that supposed to be Tony Blair?" And I was like, "I'll call you right back." And then I watched it some more, and I go back and go, "All right, now who's this?" And he was like, "Tony Blair." And I was like, "Yeah." And he's like, "All right." And I hung up. And so, yeah, I did Tony Blair, and I had to come up with some bit for him, like, really fast, like, in my dressing room before I went out to audition. And I remember getting in the elevator for my audition, and there was a guy next to me who had a backpack full of props and wigs and things. And I went, "Oh, my God, that guy is so prepared. I have nothing. I have no props." And that was Andy Samberg. And Andy Samberg said he was looking at me going, "Oh, that guy has no props. He doesn't need props." And that was the first time we met. It was in that elevator.
Oh, that's great. So you did Vinny Videcci for your audition. And, you know, he's a character you've done on Saturday Night Live. And he hosts a talk show and, you know, has on celebrities. But you once did him, and this is on YouTube for anybody who wants to see it. You once did him at Garage Comedy, which is a comedy club, I assume. And you were introduced by the MC as the replacement for a comic who had to cancel. And she said, "The comic we're going to hear is actually our busboy, but he used to be Italy's top comic impressionist back in 1985.
Right.
And then you come on stage and start, like, speaking in Italian or faux Italian.
Yeah, it's Italian gibberish.
gibberish, yeah. And then you start doing your impression. So I'm going to play just, like, an excerpt of that.
Pressione, this is Mr. Gregory Peck in To Kill the Mockingbird, very famous race car driving movie. Scout, you are not a lady. You're a tomboy. And do you know what they call tomboys when they grow up, Scout? Bull dykes.
So do the people in the audience know that you were Bill Hader, or did they really think that you were a busboy?
I think a lot of them knew I was. I think they knew it was a bit that I was doing.
And why were you doing it? I mean, were you testing something out?
That actually was before I was on SNL, I think. That was before I was even on SNL. That was my first, that was me probably working out my audition, that clip. Before I got SNL, I would try stuff out at live audiences. I was in a sketch group at the time, and quick version of a long story, Megan Mullally saw me in a show, recommended me to Lorne Michaels. Lorne Michaels came to L.A. and said, "I want to see you in your sketch show," the show that Megan Mullally saw. So we put on a sketch show, and in it, I did Vinny Videcci doing impressions, kind of like what you heard, but as a sketch. So it was like I snuck an audition into a bigger sketch show.
And Lauren, it went great, but Lauren, I think, kind of was like, oh, these are all his friends in the audience because the place is going crazy. They all know I'm here. So Lauren said, you got to come to New York and do it at UCB Theater, in an audience where no one knows you. So we came and did the show in New York with the sketch group, and we looked out, you know, in the audience, and there's Tina Fey and Seth Meyers and Amy Poehler, and I was like, oh, my gosh. I was like, plus with a bunch of New York people going, who are these guys from L.A.? Because they all knew, well, look, all the SNL brass is here. Who are these people? Oddly enough, just, you know, Bobby Moynihan was in the audience, who later got on the show. And I did that, what you kind of heard, that Jenny Videcci. And I will always be thankful for this. Amy Poehler laughed really loud, and it kind of made the whole audience relax because they went, oh, Amy Poehler finds this funny. We can kind of relax. This is funny.
So the new season of Saturday Night Live starts in September, and, you know, a lot of people are buzzing, gee, what's it going to be like now without Andy Samberg and without Kristen Wiig, who both left at the end of last season? Are you glad that you're staying on the show? Was it a hard decision whether to renew your contract or leave the show and try to have more of a movie career?
No, it was pretty easy. I mean, I've been contracted for another season for a couple of years, and I love it there. I mean, the thing with Andy and Kristen that was hard for me personally, where they were part of the group along with Jason Sudeikis that I came in with. So when you come in with a group of people, you all kind of become, your careers get a giant boost at the same time, you know what I mean? And you all hit the same learning curve at the same time, you know what I mean? So I feel very close to them, you know, they're almost like siblings to me. So when they left, it was kind of like, you know, your sibling's going off to college. You know what I mean? It's like, mm-hmm. Oh, we're not going to share a house anymore. It was that kind of feeling where it was very emotional. Yeah. I will be honest. I was surprised at how emotional it was. I was like, oh, I'm going to see you guys. Like, we're friends, you know. But after the show, yeah, in the hallway and stuff with Andy and Kristen, I mean, we were all, Andy and I were a mess.
Bill Hader speaking with Terry Gross. He's nominated for an Emmy for his work on Saturday Night Live. You'll find a longer version of this interview and all the interviews heard on Fresh Air Weekend online at freshair.npr.org.